This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Bush administration started calling for regime change in Iraq after September 11th, but the idea of removing Saddam Hussein from power has a much longer history among a group of policy analysts who are now officials in the Bush administration. These analysts have been writing documents over the past decade outlining a new vision for the role of the United States in a post-Cold War world. These documents advocate preemptive action and regime change as part of a larger strategy to remake the Gulf and the Middle East and protect our interests there. A little later, we'll hear from William Kristol, an author of one of the documents. He's the editor of the Weekly Standard and the chair of the Project for the New American Century. First, we're going to talk with Joseph Cirincione, who has studied these papers and how they've influenced U.S. foreign policy. He's the director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I asked him to outline the larger strategy and doctrine that's expressed in these papers.
There's a group of people in the administration, usually called the neoconservatives, bolstered by columnists and editors outside the administration, who believe that the role of U.S. power should be not just to manage the world, but to transform it. What's the point of being a hegemon if we can't remake the world in our image? So they see Iraq as the beginning, not the end, of this process. There's a sort of a short-term agenda, which is to transform all the regimes in the Middle East. That may seem sweepingly ambitious to some, but it's just the beginning of this view that what the United States can do is go into a region or confront a country that we disagree with and force that country to change its government. And in so doing, we can create a more stable situation for the world as well as for the United States. So after Iraq, the idea would be, and they've talked about this, that the people in neighboring countries, Syria and Iran, would be encouraged to rise up and overthrow their governments, with the help, of course, of U.S. troops who would now be based in Iraq. And this would spread to all the other countries, including Saudi Arabia. In this way, we can transform the Arab governments, create a democratic Palestinian Authority, and give Israel a credible and reliable negotiating partner. That would then secure U.S. interest in the vital region of the Persian Gulf for decades to come. But, of course, that's just that one region. After this, we would continue to remake basically all of the international institutions that we've come to rely on since the Cold War.
Well, if the United States wants to spread democracy around the world, what's your objection to that?
You can't spread democracy on the point of bayonets. That spreading democracy, creating democratic institutions, transforming countries, requires primarily the efforts of the people themselves in those countries. That's the way we did it. That's the way most countries do it. Can you support those? Yes. But you can't liberate a people by invading them. And more importantly, what this group wants to do is first tear down the existing institutions that we have to promote peace and security and democracy in the world. Most importantly, the United Nations. It may come as something of a surprise to the American people who support the United Nations in overwhelming numbers that a group like the editors of the Weekly Standard on their March 17th cover call the United Nations, present the United Nations as present at the destruction. The United Nations implodes. And the contributing editors go on to argue inside that newspaper, that journal, that the United States, United Nations today is an impediment to world safety. It should be replaced. Charles Krauthammer, a prominent neoconservative columnist, says the president should simply walk away from the United Nations. They see these international, these multilateral institutions now as hindrances to U.S. power.
Let's talk about some of the earlier documents that relate to the Gulf War. Let's go back to a 1992 document called the Defense Policy Guidance Document. What is this document, and what does it spell out that seems to connect to the actions we're taking now in Iraq?
In 1991, when the Gulf War ended, Paul Wolfowitz was then Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for policy. He was very unhappy. He did not want the war to end so soon. He was put in charge in 1992 of drafting the guidance for the Department of Defense, what would guide U.S. national security strategy as far as the department was concerned. And he produced a document that was very controversial, so controversial that people in the Pentagon who opposed this point of view leaked it to the New York Times. And when it was leaked, it was seen as an extremist view, and Wolfowitz was forced to withdraw it and was rewritten. What was extremist about it was that he called for a policy where the U.S. would seek to prevent any other country from challenging U.S. power, either globally or regionally. He proposed a policy of preemption, where we would go and attack based on the speculation that a country might someday threaten U.S. interests, and he specifically proposed preparing for several regional contingencies, including another war in Iraq. Now, remember, this is just a few months after the 91 Iraq War ended. That document was withdrawn. Preemption was replaced by containment. They put out a fairly bland defense policy guidance document. But these elements, this strategy, is now what's in the current U.S. national security strategy. They worked during their years of exile, when Republicans were replaced by Democrats in the White House, organized, cooperated, hammered out a common political line. And when Bush came back into office, this group assumed key positions. Almost, if you look at it, almost all the important sub-cabinet positions right below the secretary in the State Department and the Defense Department are now filled by these neoconservatives, people who work together, who know each other, who often worked for each other, and they were successful in dominating the policy apparatus and pushing through what used to be considered an extreme point of view.
And Paul Wolfowitz, the author of the report you just mentioned, is now Deputy Defense Secretary.
Yes, he's the leading both intellectual leader of the neoconservatives and the highest ranking neoconservative in office.
Now, another document that seems to relate to the current war in Iraq is one from 1998 in which 18 people wrote a letter to President Clinton urging him to remove Saddam Hussein, remove the Saddam Hussein regime from power. Who was behind this letter and what was it about?
Well, Bill Kristol formed an organization called the Project for the New American Century and used that to bring together leading neoconservative thinkers and experts and to get clear on what their position was, what was their strategy. It's a very effective organizing tool. I mean, these guys are smart, they're dedicated, they know what they're doing. And this letter did two things. One, it told President Clinton, this was in early 1998, that he should focus on removing Saddam Hussein from power, that inspections, if they ever had failed, that there was unlikely they would ever be reimposed, and that the policy of the United States should be to change the regime. And it wasn't just the idea, but it was this. They used it as an organizing tool to line up support, and they had 15 prominent experts sign it, many of whom have now ended up in senior administration positions in the Bush administration, including, for example, Paul Wolfowitz. Richard Perle recently resigned as head of the Defense Policy Panel, and many others.
So this letter said that removing Saddam Hussein needed to become the aim of American foreign policy.
That's right. That it wasn't enough to contain him, which is what the policy had been, or to try and bring inspections back. The only solution was to go in with military force and take him out.
Joseph Cerencioni, in the year 2000, a report was issued called Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. It was issued by the Project for the New American Century, a group chaired by William Kristol, who also edits the conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard. What's the connection of this report to the strategy behind the war in Iraq?
Well, this document was basically adopted by the Bush administration when they took office as their defense and national security program. It's just remarkable. You read this report, and it's point for point has been taken up by the administration. Large increases in defense spending, specific recommendations on weapon systems, a policy of preemptive attack, the need to change the base structure of the United States, so move it from bases in Europe to bases in, well, the Middle East or parts of Asia now. the idea that what we're doing is expanding U.S. influence in the world. We're taking advantage of the collapse of the Soviet Union and now moving into areas of the world that we haven't been in before and asserting American military dominance. Some might see that as a new form of colonialism. They see it as the spread of democracy and U.S. power.
One more report I want to ask you about, and this is the National Security Strategy of the United States, a report issued in September 2002. What's this report and how does it connect to the war in Iraq?
Well, the National Security Strategy of the United States is issued every year, and it's sort of the president's vision of how he sees the world. Often it's just a bureaucratic document, but Condoleezza Rice was very clear that this time they were going to use this to lay out the new Bush doctrine, the new Bush vision, and it broke new ground. So, for example, quote, "We will not hesitate to act alone, and if necessary, act preemptively." This idea that the alliances were fine as far as they went, but that the U.S. would take a much more aggressive posture towards the world and would act when it saw fit, getting together ad hoc coalitions when alliances could not be orchestrated. As a result, the U.S. now is implementing this policy in Iraq. It really is remarkable how quickly these ideas went from the extreme end of the political spectrum to center stage in official U.S. national security documents to implementation in the battlefield of Iraq.
How do you think that it happened, that these ideas went from the fringe to the mainstream of the administration?
Well, two things. One was the appointment process itself. It turns out that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and President Bush himself were much more radical than people thought when they were elected. And you remember the president was talking about a humble foreign policy, wanted to take troops out of Kosovo, didn't want to be arrogant. He debated Al Gore in his third presidential debate and said, if we're arrogant, countries won't respect us. We have to be patient and strong, not arrogant and weak. Well, what happened was when they went to the appointment process, they had some key people, such as Scooter Libby, who was the Vice President Cheney's national security advisor, in position to help steer the appointment process. So the administration basically was flooded with a group of neoconservatives who all thought alike, who all had worked together. And what that meant was, as we go into interagency meetings below the cabinet level, you end up with a bunch of people who all already know each other, already have worked out these problems, already have a strategy. They push it through, it gets talked up, and it gets presented with apparently a great deal of unanimity from the ranks up to the chief policymakers. Still, these ideas were so radical they probably would not have been adopted except for September 11th. And that was such a shock to the country and to the president that they were looking for something dramatic to do. And in a series of articles by various journalists have pointed out the key role that Paul Wolfowitz played. On September 12th, he was arguing with the president, telling him we had to go invade Iraq. On September 15th, at the key meeting at Camp David, Paul Wolfowitz was there pushing the invasion of Iraq. It didn't take at the time, but a few months later, the president was won over to this view. And this is a president who doesn't have much foreign policy experience. As people say, when he was running for the presidency, he literally went to school. A group of experts went down to Texas to educate him about foreign policy. So this relatively empty vessel was just filled with this view, this vision, this coherent framework, and he took to it. It just fit him like a glove, in part because it fit in with his own evangelical view of the world and the role of the United States and the power that ideas and faith can have in changing the world. So we found the perfect marriage between a somewhat inexperienced president on foreign policy who had this evangelical bent and this group of visionaries in the administration who were out to change the world. And that, in more than any other factor, more than weapons of mass destruction, more than terrorism, is what has brought us to the battlefields of Iraq.
When you say that this doctrine fits the president's evangelical view of the world, what do you mean?
Well, the president has said, for example, that we are in a war between fear and freedom, and God is not neutral in that struggle. He really does see himself at this historic moment, this cusp of history where everything is in play, everything is in motion, and that he and his administration can play this crusading role to rescue the world from evil. And so there's evil arrayed on one side, there's good and God arrayed on the other, and that God is with us, providence is with us, and that this impels his decision and helps promote the goals that he now has laid out for the country. Unfortunately, all the countries in conflict in the Middle East think that God is on their side. They all feel that they are acting with God's blessings and that they will be rewarded in the end for carrying out their policies. In some ways, the president's view feeds in to this Middle Eastern dynamic, doesn't replace it.
Now, some people, when they connect the dots between the war in Iraq and the documents that you described leading up to the war in Iraq, the documents outlining the strategy that we appear to be following now, outlining the doctrine that we appear to be following now, some of those people see this as a conspiracy theory, you know, and behind it is a cabal of people who've been wanting to do this all along. Do you see this as a conspiracy theory?
No, because they've been quite open about what they think. It's a conspiracy in plain sight, I guess. All you have to do is go read the documents, go read the Weekly Standard, go to the American Enterprise Institute, look at what these people say. They are openly advocating this. The one element you do have there is they're very well organized. This is a tight-knit group of people who have been working together for some time, and we're not quite used to that. We haven't really experienced as a country the policy domination that we have now by a group of people whose interests transcend the particular administration that they're in.
How would you compare the architect's projections of what would happen when we invaded Iraq with what is actually happening so far in that war?
These people have talked and pushed and championed the cause of war for years now. And they, more than anyone else, more than the president himself, are responsible for bringing us in this war. And it is turning into a disaster. It's really a shock for some of them. They really thought, as Vice President Cheney said, that Saddam would fall like a house of cards. Richard Pearl said that the regime would collapse at the first whiff of gunpowder. It would topple like a hollow log. They really believed this, and the reason they believed it is that they know nothing about the region, and that they completely underestimate the force of nationalism. Once again, the U.S. underestimates nationalism. Why people fight for their land, for their village, even though their land is ruled by a tyrant who oppresses them. I think it will be a disaster. I don't think that it's certain that we're going to win this war, as some of our military commanders are now telling us, but it is likely that the military will be able to prevail and suppress any resistance in Iraq. But what this unfortunately tells us about the future occupation of Iraq is that it's going to be difficult, it is going to be bloody, that even if there's a minority of that country that still opposes us, that's going to be tens of thousands of people fighting us, attacking us, sniping at us.
Well, it sounds like you believe we might, in fact, be entering a new era, but you think it's not a very good new era. Project forward a little bit. What are some of the problems you think we might run into in this new era?
We're seeing it already. We have tens of thousands of people demonstrating in Arab capitals against us. We have thousands of people telling us that they're going to kill themselves to oppose us. We have exactly what I and others have warned about, new waves of recruits into al-Qaeda-like organizations. You know, this is not the battle that the American people were promised. This was supposed to be a liberation of the people of Iraq. Does it look like a liberation to you? It sure doesn't to me. We're in a situation where American troops once again can't tell the enemy from the civilians they're supposed to be liberating, where you see stories of kids with their fingers on triggers hesitating. Is that a soldier or is that a civilian? Is that a woman or is that somebody who's luring me into a trap? You know, when you cannot bring democracy to a country, when that's the situation you're facing, I don't think it's going to change. I know we're being told right now that once Saddam is gone, that this will all become clear, the support will collapse and everybody will come over to our side. They're not paying attention to what the Shiites in the South are saying. Their leader is an Ayatollah in exile that they want to bring back to power. They want a Shiite Islamic rule in Iraq, not a Western democracy rule.
You're a non-proliferation expert. We are facing two countries now that seem to be adding nuclear weapons to their arsenal, North Korea and Iran. What kind of model are we creating with Iraq? And do you have any sense of how Iran and North Korea are interpreting what we're doing in Iraq in terms of what their future might be?
What lesson will North Korea and Iran draw from the war in Iraq? Do they curtail their nuclear ambitions or speed them up? The evidence so far seems to be that they're speeding them up, that the lesson they're drawing is that they better get a nuclear weapon quick before the United States comes after them. And in fact, those two countries are on the president's axis of evil list and on the administration's to-do list. There are some who I've spoken to in the administration who, after the Iraq war is over, want to go on either to Iran or to North Korea and try the same strategy with them. This is even more difficult. There are no good military options for either one of those countries, but they want to use that same kind of coercive diplomacy, not negotiations, but force them to end their programs and to come in line with the United States. I believe the Iranians and the North Koreans see that coming and are trying to increase their negotiating position by acquiring nuclear weapons as quickly as they can.
What position would that leave us in?
This means that the world is going to be a lot more dangerous than it was 2 years ago when the Bush administration came into office. You know, like all administrations, they inherited problems from the previous administration, but they've taken those problems and they've turned them into crises. North Korea is a problem. Iran is a problem. But they're escalating them by their mishandling of their situation into a crisis. But it's not just those two countries. We think, well, those are sort of opposed against us. What about some of our allies, like Pakistan? I mean, here's a country that has 30 to 50 nuclear weapons, that has sold the uranium enrichment equipment to North Korea to help them secretly start a uranium enrichment program, that probably has sold Iran the uranium enrichment equipment that they're using for their nuclear program. There were tens of thousands of people in the streets demonstrating against the U.S. war in the streets of Peshawar, over the weekend, one in a series of demonstrations being called by the Islamic opposition in Pakistan. If Pakistan destabilizes or goes over to an Islamic fundamentalist government, then we're going to have a proliferation problems the likes of which we have never seen. Then we really are going to have loose Islamic nukes. That is a nightmare scenario. And unfortunately, the policies of this administration are making that more likely, not less likely.
Joseph Cervincioni, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me in the studios, Terry.
Joseph Cervincioni is the director of the Nonproliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.